Okay, everyone. Hello again, and March 22nd. Good to be here. This is class 43, and as the rabbi mentioned, we'll meet again in 3 weeks because I get back too late after Pesach. God willing, it'll be too late to really prepare. As always, I have lots of stuff to show you. I'll try to keep it to 15 minutes so that we can move forward, but some of this is really interesting and relevant to what we were doing with the class. The first thing I want to show you, let's see. Gotta find, where's my screen? I have so many screens open, it's hard to find. Okay, actually, this is not what I meant to show you, but it popped up, so I'll show you that.
I think you're muted. I think you're trying to talk, but we don't hear you.
We hear him, Rabbi.
No, I wasn't muted. You can hear me when I show the screen, can't you?
I hear you, Dr.
Am I the only one who doesn't hear, or is everybody else also?
No, you can hear me now.
Yeah, I hear.
You hear me? This is what I meant to show you, but this has been going around. Now you can get your, I don't know if it's a kashrus thing or just people are too lazy to make salt water, but not that it's that complicated. You take some water and put a little salt in. But we saw last week about the masks, but this isn't what I wanted to show you. So let me get rid of that. Hold on. Now let me show you what I really wanted to show you. Okay, where is the page here? I have so many pages I want to show you here. I don't know where to begin. I'm going to begin with this one, with Rabbi, if you remember Rabbi Amsalem. For some reason, he's running in for the election, the Knesset. He's not any seats whatsoever. I put this up on YouTube a few minutes ago. I don't know why he's running. He's not going to win. Any vote for him is a complete waste. That's him in the middle. But whatever, everyone has the right to run. So the second person on the list is a woman. Now, for some reason, he got the one of the Avbeistins in Jerusalem, Rabbi Abergel, who we've also discussed, to endorse the party, which it's like a Sephardic moderate type of party, which must mean that Rabbi Abergel is not doesn't hold an official government office, must be retired, or else you can't endorse. But listen to what he says for those who know Hebrew, and I'll translate it for those who don't.
Arav, מה דעתו של הרב מבחינה הלכתית? האם נשים זה טוב שהם יהיו בכנסת? צריך שיהיו בכנסת או שזה חובה?
הרב עוזאל עליו השלום בספרו משפטי עוזאל, הוא כבר הרב עובדיה עליו השלום, כתבו בדבר הזה שאישה יכולה להיות גם בכנסת, גם להיות ראש ממשלה. כל האיסור היה על תפקידים כאלה שהם לנצח. אבל תפקידים שהם זמניים, אין שום בעיה.
אבל למה? אבל הרב אומר את זה גם על מפלגה חרדית, כן? לא סתם.
כן, כן, כן.
גם בתוך מפלגה חרדית שתהיה אישה.
כן, יכול להיות, אין שום בעיה.
So this is Rabbi Abergel, author of 10 volumes of Tshuvot, in which he declares there's no issue for a woman to be in the Knesset or to be a prime minister, that the whole issue of Sarara is like permanent sort of appointments, not temporary things. So that's I think, of interest, significant. Let me get rid of this. We spoke about the dinner, the halachic dinner that Rabbi Zivotofsky and also Rabbi Slifkin had. So now, if those of you in Israel, if you want to get your locusts, for Pesach, you can pick them up, the kosher locusts. I looked in the Gurok's book. I have it here, Judaism's Encounter with American Sports. And I see I misremembered. First of all, his mention of the Mechitar is not in the preface. It's on page 82 to 83. But I was wrong in a different reason as well. He tells the story of the Mechitar in already back in Eastern Europe, I guess in Poland, that he was once walking with Mayor Berlin and they found some youngsters from a gymnasium school in Brisk, actually, it was in Brisk, Lithuania. And it was then that the maitre d' remarked, why didn't we have this when we were youngsters? I don't think that's true. I don't think that's the story. It's not in Brisk. The story, as I've always heard it, it was at Yeshivas or Ritz Elchana. I don't think that they'd be playing basketball or anything in Brisk or whatever they were playing. I just don't think that's the story. I think Gurak has it confused. And I mean, Gurek's not a person from Yeshiva. He's been teaching him many years, but Rekefed, who grew up in YU, and he repeats the story the way I said it. It's a legend. A well-known story at Yeshiva Serbitz of Lachanan. I want to show you some pictures here. I mentioned the Chabad in Delhi. So you're sitting down, which is good, because I want to show you a couple things here. Oh, before I get to that, I want to show you this as well. Lo and behold, we've been speaking so much about Rabbi Mazuz. We only have like two more letters from him, but he wrote a poem about the Rambam. And lo and behold, Hanukkah, 2 years ago, who wrote a song to the poem? I'll play you a minute of it. And if you believe him, he says that he created this. He hadn't yet seen the poem. He did this song for the first time reading it. I don't know if I can believe that. I don't know anyone, even a person as talented as this, can just hold something in their hand and start singing. But that's what he claims. And you'll see this person in a minute. I don't know if the Sephardim in the audience know what Halakha Rambam means. But lo and behold, look who sang the song from Rabbi Mazuz's poem about the Rambam. This is Lippmann Schmelzer, for those who don't know. Okay, so there's Lipa Schmelzer. Very good. Now, I mentioned last class going to India. I want to show you some things because it really speaks to the theology I spoke about. We're going to be seeing the Lubavitcher Rebbe's letters in a few minutes. But I want to show, I said last week that the people in India are really crazy. So let me show you some things here, first of all. These are, if you come to, well, here's Dharamshala, by the way. You should recognize what this is. This is Dharamshala. It's where the Dalai Lama is. That's the same, that's 770. I'll show you what 770 looks like. They make it exactly the same. Here's 770. But this isn't really what is of concern. What's concern is the following. Take a look at this. Well, first, as you can't miss the Chabad house, because as you're walking down the street in India, in a bad neighborhood, by the way, I should say a very rundown neighborhood, you have, it tells you where the Beit Chabad is. And then if you go into it, you find, right, I'll show you what it looks like right inside. This is in Delhi. So, of course, you see here, right behind the Aron Kodesh, but then you have as follows. Now, this is the thing we need to explain a bit about. Inside every one of the Sfarim there, you have this writing. Well, it says Yichiy Adonai Marina Melech Mashiach Lamed Harebi Milubavitch Melech Mashiach Shlita Chai VeKayam Lelo Shinoi DeGeniza. So, what does this mean that the Rebbe is alive without without any Shinoi of Geniza? Well, you can easily look online, for instance, if you're interested. I'll show you one place, and you can see this all explained. For example, in this article here, what does it mean, Ein Shinoi de Geniza? They explain that the Nasi Hador, he still is around without any change. Nasi Hador, he doesn't go to another place. Ela Nishar Lo'olam Va'ed Ba'oto Makom Mesuyam Ba'olam Hagashmi. The Rebbe is still with us in the physical world. And if you go down in the article with this idea of Shinoi de Geniza, because they speak about the Aron, the Gemara talks about, there's a dispute over what happened to the Aron after the first Beis Hamikdash. Some say it was brought to Bavel, others say it was Nignaz, it was like hidden, but it still had significance, even if it was. And what they're saying is that the Rebbe, it's not that he's not hidden even. I'll read you, let's see, hold on, I gotta find it here, I made a note. Here, so they say he talks about how before the Rebbe's passing, or they wouldn't say that, everyone knew where the Rebbe was. But then he goes on to say that this place will remain the Rebbe's place, Lo Shinoi, Nasi Adar Lo Avram Nakam Acher, Kadosh Kechol Shiyah, El Nishar Lo'om Va'ed, Ba'oto Makom Mesuyam Ba'olam Hagashmi. So the way I understand it is that they're saying that the Rebbe, we can't see him, but he still exists in his physical body. This is the equivalent of the Shia conception of occultation, that is the final, the last of the imams, they believe, never died, but he was removed bodily. We just can't see it. Does that mean that I think that means that there's no one in the grave, although unless they have this conception that the Rebbe's physicality continues and the body is no longer, the body has nothing to do with the physicality. I really don't know about the theology. I didn't want to ask. I was their guest, and it was a very strange weekend. I was there with a guy from England, and we're sitting around the Shabbos table, and he said something to me like, do you feel like we're the only normal people here? You're sitting with all these Israelis, and you're hearing this stuff. Anywhere else, you'd think that this is crazy, far out. And here, you're the minority. It's like you're looking around, you're wondering if you're the crazy people, because that's the stuff you're hearing. And yet the people were so nice. But to say that the Rebbe is still in the world, no changes. Except we can't see it, but he remains where he was in a physical way. A Chabad person wrote to me today. I asked him about this. Yes, there are a few people who make the claim that they believe in the square circle paradox of the Rebbe's continued physical life, which can't be seen, touched, or otherwise perceived in the human senses. However, it remains a nonsensical statement that can't actually mean anything. So any attempt to analyze it would be ludicrous by definition. This is from a Chabadnik, but that's in all the Sfarim, and they have a thing on their website. You can send in an email, and you can do. So there's a machine, a thing they have online, and it automatically will open the pages of the Rebbe's books of Sichot or letters, and he's giving you the answer that way. So just strange stuff going on over in India. Let me wait 2 more minutes. I want to tell you 2 more things. Remember we spoke last week about Chabad, but a more mainstream Chabad, Rabbi Elazar, and I said that if he's summoned by Putin, there's no question he would have to go get in the car on Shabbos or Yom Tov. And I don't think there's any posek in the world who would disagree. We do things, we have doctors violate Melacha D'Oraisa on Shabbos because we're afraid what it might lead to with non-Jews. So all the more so a case like this. There's no doubt. And every rabbi I've spoken to says doesn't have any question whatsoever. Dov S, who listens to the classes, said that... Well, isn't that what happened with Mendelssohn? He reminded me. Mendelssohn, you can read all about it in Alexander Altman's book on Mendelssohn on page 275 and 276. He was summoned on Shmini Atzeres by Emperor Frederick II of Prussia to come in his carriage, which is the same thing. It's an Isser Derabanan. And what happened was that they called together a meeting. This is a non-Jew wrote about this, a meeting of experts, the chief rabbi, because Mendelssohn didn't know what to do. It's Yom Tov. He can't go in a carriage, but he's summoned by the emperor. And what this group of experts convened by the chief rabbi decided that, of course, he, in this case, he should go in the carriage, but in order that, because people might be ignorant, they might get the wrong impression, when he comes to the gate of Berlin, I guess where there's a lot of people, then he should get off and walk through before entering where the palace is. So the same exact thing happened with Mendelssohn. And he went to the rabbis, because Mendelssohn was a Shomer Shabbos. He wasn't sure what he's supposed to do. Okay, the last thing I want to do is as follows, and then we'll move on. I want to play you something from 2 weeks ago and show you why I think there's a mistake in what Dolphin said. Listen to this. And this comes from a student. I was going to say a Talmud. But thanks to Cole, I'll say a student of Rabbi Ruderman. And he says as follows, once while arranging, this comes from Rabbi Janowski of Miami. Once while arranging his library, Rabbi Ruderman related that Rabbi Huttner asked him what he thought of his approach, referring to him demanding respect, kavod haTorah, and practicing an elitist form of gadlus haAdam, when you stress the greatness of man. Rabbi Ruderman replied, he quotes the Yiddish, du foilst sich lernen Gemara, Rashi and Tosfos, hastu gemach anayim derech. You are lazy, too lazy to study the Talmud with the commentators, so you made a new approach. That's the... And we spoke about that. Now, Rabbi Aryeh Leib, I guess he didn't see that I was reading from Dolphin. Chaim Dolphin, who we spoke about, who's published all these books. I have to say, I read another one over Shabbos, unfortunately, with all the good information it needs an editor, because it's hard. You can't even go two pages without a grammatical problem, a spelling mistake. It's unfortunate. But Rabbi Aryeh Leib said that he thought that I was the one saying that what he's speaking about is Kavod haTorah, the new derech. But I was just reading from Dolphin. But Rabbi Aryeh Leib says something which is correct, I think, thinking that I was the one who made the mistake. I am sure what Rabbi Janowski said is he told Chaim Dolphin the story, and that Rabbi Huttner asked Rabbi Ruderman, what do you think of my new derech? And Rabbi Ruderman replied somewhat, giving him a bit of a jab, that's because you don't want to learn Gemara and Tosfos, you do this. It's not about Kavod haTorah. What he was asking about was, is Dolphin's wrong. Dolphin makes it seem as if I'm certain of this, that's what Janowski said. I, now that I read it again, Janowski just said the new derech. It's Dolphin understanding this to mean this derech of Kavod haTorah, where the people have to walk out backwards and give you respect and all that stuff. As Rabbi Aryeh Leib said, Rav Huttner was the only one of the Gedolim from Lita who insisted on this respect, but that's not what it's referring to. It's obvious he's referring, Rav Huttner, we know, was into Machshava and philosophy. That's what he was asking about. So he asked Rabbi Ruderman, what do you think about my approach? And Rav Ruderman said that your approach, where you focus on Maharal, etc., that's only because you don't want to, put the time into learning Gemara. That's clearly what it means. So thank you, Rabbi Aryeh Leib. By the way, I had conversation with a number of you over this, and one of you asked me, what about the Gemara says in Chazal, if you run away from Kavod, Kavod comes after you? And things like that. The truth is, there is no such statement in Chazal. Believe it or not, in Rav Shmuel Ashkenazi's new book, Igrot Shmuel, volume 1, page 192, he shows that the earliest citation of this is like from about 500 years ago. There's similar passages, Like someone in Sefer Chassidim, it says, I ran away from Kavod, barachti min haKavod, and Kavod came after me. But it doesn't actually say, there's no such rabbinic expression if you run away from Kavod. And as for Kavod, let me share you, this is great. If you look in Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, and this will be the last thing we do, in the collected Chidushim of Rabbi Weinberg, Chidushei Baal Sridei Eish, volume 3, page 28, it says as follows. This shows the honesty of Rabbi Weinberg. And he's quoted by his student, and I thank his student for quoting it. The problem with all these gedolim is, we have to thank Nosson Kamenetsky, is most of the people who knew them well are afraid to say what they really said about things. They cover up, they do other things. That's why I like the book Masoras Moshe, at least the first two volumes. And listen to what Rabbi Weinberg said. He says, once Rabbi Weinberg said to me, Kulanu b'nei Adam, we're all people. Gam ani ohev kavod. Rabbi Weinberg says, he's one of the gedolei Yisrael, I also like kavod. But I try not to chase after it. But if they're going to give me kavod, I'll take it. But I don't try to chase after it. That's and who can say they don't like a little kavod? So Rabbi Weinberg is being honest in saying that. And then he says, then he follows with a good story. He says that once this important rabbi came to Montreux, Switzerland, and he was staying in the Jewish pension. And Rabbi Weinberg said to me, let's go visit this rabbi. So I said back to him, this Rabbi Weinberg, why should you go visit him? He's visiting Montreux. He should come visit you. That's suitable. And Rabbi Weinberg says, Hatatzodeik. You are correct. But if I go visit him, then I decide when it's time to leave. If he comes to me, I can't exactly kick him out. And the same story is found. Saul Lieberman used to always go visit Rabbi Zevin. He wouldn't have Rav Zevin visit him because he said, Rav Zevin's a chassid. He comes to visit me and you never know what you can get rid of him. We'll keep talking and talking. So enough for the stories. Let us continue. If you recall, we're on Siman 151, we're dealing with, 150, we're dealing with, I gave you the introduction last week, how I got to have Yechidus with the Rebbe, how Rabbi Herson, who's the head, you know, he's head of Rebbe College, head of the Shluchim in New Jersey. By the way, this word Shluchim, well, why Shluchim? What is that? The people don't know this, and it's not in modern Hebrew, I'm certain. David can correct me, Eisen, if I'm wrong. It's not in modern Hebrew. But in rabbinic Hebrew, the plural of the word shaliach is shaluchim. It's not shalichim, it's shaluchim. Shalucho shaladam kamoso, even not the plural, but with a suffix. The Rambam in the Mishnah Torah is hilchos, was it? Shulchim v'shutfin? I forgot now. Shluchin v'shutfin. Yeah, shluchin. So it's not shlichin. The Gemara, I found in the Mishnah, in Mishnah of Rosh Hashanah, al shisha chodashim ha-shluchin yotzin. So that is the plural of shaliach. Why that's the plural? Look in Ben Yehuda. He doesn't really have a good explanation. But that is it. So that's why the Chabad, when you refer to them as shluchim, it's not, there's a certain rabbi on also does things online, and sometimes he speaks about Chabad, he refers to a shaluach. He's a shaluach because the plural is shluchim. It's not true, though, and Chabad don't say that. They say shliach, but plural is shluchim. And David Eisen, as he says, that in modern Hebrew, it's shlichim, but that's not rabbinic Hebrew. So we gave the whole story about the Rebbe. Now, when we went to the Rebbe, my father's a historian, so the Rebbe said to him, well, send me some of your writings. And the Rebbe was always interested. He always wanted everyone's writings. Put it in his library. And the Rebbe had correspondence. Of course, he had Torah correspondence, but he also had correspondence with all sorts of people. Here's a book that came out 2 years ago. Dear Rebbe, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson corresponds with a singer, a writer, a sculptor, and a Holocaust survivor. This is just a collection of his correspondence with Jacques Lipschitz, who's a sculptor. Of course, sculptors are a problem halachically. John Pierce, the singer. David Chase, the wealthy Holocaust survivor who funded many Chabad programs, including the Rabbinical College, and Chaim Grada. And he corresponded with many, many others like that. I don't know where the Rebbe found the time. It's, he'd sometimes have these yechidos going into 4 a.m. or even later. I don't know when he found time to learn, to prepare. He's meeting people constantly. He's responding, but he must have only needed 2-3 hours sleep. So he writes, and after my father sent him the materials, he writes back, acknowledging, what you sent me and after the visit with your sons in connection with Melech's bar mitzvah. That's myself. And he does, it's a long letter here. It's nothing groundbreaking, anything. Like, it's the sort of stuff you've heard again and again. But let me just call attention to a few things he points out. Well, first of all, this isn't just a form letter. In fact, I have the original, and it has the Rebbe's handwritten. In other words, after it was typed up, he read it over and he put in some words there that were missing. And he writes, for example, to my father, anyone, especially a historian, reflecting on the long history of our Jewish people. So this isn't just this is an actual letter written to my father, not one of these letters that they just form letters. And he speaks about the things that we all know, that although the Jews have suffered so much, nevertheless, we remain, and the other people are gone. And he says, he talks about how the usual factors which are important for national identity and preservation, insofar as other nations are concerned, notably territory, statehood, language, dress, he says, is not essential to the Jews. We didn't have this. We didn't have a territory. We didn't have statehood. We didn't have one language. We didn't have one dress. So what kept us a people? The Torah. This is something we all know, but it's very nice to see it as the Rebbe putting it together. And he talks about how the Torah studied in different languages. It goes on and on and on. But then he says at the end, and this I think is interesting. I never heard this before. He says, as a matter of fact, which I have had occasion to point out before, our contemporary generation is more privileged than the early generations who received the Torah from Moshe Rabbeinu and his successors. Why does he say that? Because they had to rely on faith to be connected. But for us, he says, we don't need to rely on faith. It's factual. Look at the history. Thousands of years of Jews. All these empires, which was supposed to last forever, they're all gone. We're all here. The Rebbe says, that's not a matter of faith. We actually have something the earlier generations didn't have. We have as close as you can get to proof that we are being watched over and that we have a purpose and we're not just some nation. And we have something that the earlier generations didn't have. Usually we think that we're much less than the early generations, but we have something they didn't have, something we can actually look at and see. If you want to prove, I always say, if you want to prove, I don't like proofs, to prove Judaism or anything like that. But the closest thing you have to the proof is the history of the Jews and what we've gone through and how we're still here. And it's not normal. So, and that's what the Rebbe says. So our survival as a nation, as members of this holy nation, this is a matter of self-evident truth, he says, reinforced by the facts and experience of our Jewish history. So, the Rebbe says he's pointed this out before, but I think this is significant. I think it's significant that Rebbe points it out in speaking to a story, and it shows you that someone who just met for a few minutes, but in writing a letter, he's cognizant of, he could have written just a short little letter, thank you. He goes into pages expounding on this, and he had to think about this when he wrote it. That's the greatness of the Rebbe, and unfortunately, many people don't see this, and they're always looking for negatives. But the Rebbe, what can you say about the Rebbe? He created a revolution in Judaism. So every time you have a revolution, you have certain dark spots and unfortunate things. But, what he accomplished in terms of the Jewish world, no one came close. And to the Rebbe's credit, and the Litvish don't like this, but it's the truth. The Litvish, who were so opposed to Kirov and all these things, Shlomo Carlbach had to leave Lakewood because of that. Now, of course, they're leaders in it. It's all because of the success of Chabad. Had Chabad not gotten into it, they never would have. And they do the exact same thing that Chabad did. How do they, they're at all these colleges now, the Litvish Haredim, and what do? They ask people, are you Jewish? And they're the same thing that, come, we're having a Seder, we're having this and that. They do the same thing that Chabad did. And Chabad, I guess, had to break the ice on it. But this is the vision of the Rebbe. And there's a lot that can be said about the Rebbe. And just because you have some crazy shulchim in certain places, that doesn't take away from all the great things that the shulchim do and and what the Rebbe did. So, and the Rebbe's a thinker. I mean, Elliot Wolfson, who's so... who's so erudite, has written so much. He wouldn't have written a whole book on the Rebbe's Kabbalistic ideas if the Rebbe wasn't a great thinker. I mean, the fact that it's hard to understand one page of that book because of the jargon it's written in, and Derrida, and all this postmodern stuff, that doesn't take away from the fact that the Rebbe is not just a doer. He's also a thinker. And most thinkers are not doers, and most doers are not thinkers. So the Rebbe is special. Now we're up to number 151. And we have two letters here from Rav Herschel Schechter from YU. I'm going to say a few things about Rav Schechter, because Rav Schechter creates different feelings among different people. I understand if people who are on the left, open Orthodox, they're not very happy with him because of his opposition to really the feminist issue, I think, mostly. So that I understand, but I also think that we're dealing with someone who is an authentic, not just an authentic gadol, an unbelievable Torah scholar, and no one's going to be happy with 100% of what someone says. It's never happened that way, but always people like to look at the glass half empty. Even if you think you said something, you know, these people sometimes they speak, or someone like him is speaking every single night, literally giving shirim every night and in all different places. I don't know when he finds the time to learn. Every night he's in a different, now he's on Zoom, but in a different town and all that. So occasionally he'll say something which maybe doesn't come out so good. But I think people, and I say this only to the people who are know him from the distance. I can say that if you speak to him personally, he's kind and he's a tzaddik, as we'll see. But leaving that apart, we should be very thankful that we have such an enormous posek and figure. When I say a leader, if Rav Lichtenstein had never gone to Israel, he would be the leader. It says something about American Orthodoxy that a leader is a posek. That's very much more on the Haredi model. I mean, Rav Schechter, great, great posek, but you're not going to ask him to speak about humanistic concerns of the day and you know, how Judaism responds to it. Know who he is. He's a posek and an outstanding, maybe the greatest in America that we have. And that's a sign of how American Orthodoxy has gone in a certain direction. Had Rabbi Lichtenstein remained in America, it would be a very different leader. But just remember this. Look at all the things we have with Rav Schechter. He stands with Agunas. Not only does he stand with Agunas, he's the one behind this. When there are protests in front of people's houses, and there's been a few in recent days, he actually marches with the people. He speaks about the importance of honesty in dealing with the government. And that shouldn't be taken for granted. He won't even let someone be a witness or at a wedding, or doesn't believe you should give him an aliyah if he's known to, let's say, be cheating on his taxes or things like that. The issues of sexual abuse. I can go down the list. Religious Zionism. So, I mean, the community should feel very fortunate. That doesn't mean that you have to agree with every aspect, he says. He might be more conservative in certain areas. But here is someone, and even the liberal Haredim look to him, that someone who on so many of the issues, and he's not afraid, he doesn't look over his shoulder, doesn't care what the, you know, the right wingers say. He tells the truth like he sees it. And it's very unusual to have someone like that. So and if you haven't heard of Shirim, I'm a big fan in many, many ways. And I'll say, I think when you see the next letter to me, you'll be very impressed as well. I've disagreed also. I've written about some things online, and I've told him that. I disagreed, and he doesn't care. And when I say I disagree, obviously I'm not on halacha to disagree, but some of his other hashkafa things, I don't feel bound to that. Leaving that, it's almost embarrassing. I need to say that I think he's one of the Gedol Yisrael, but I know because in the Jewish week and the Western and the Jewish press, sometimes they like to go after him as someone who represents a view they don't like. And I can tell you private things, maybe I shouldn't tell you, that you'd be shocked at the liberality. One thing I can say, because it's public, telling Orthodox rabbis they should go to Reform synagogues and speak to the communities there, the Rav never would agree with that, at least I don't think. Rav Schechter thinks it's very important, because if you don't go to give him Torah, they're never going to get it, to go to Limud, to do all these things. And I know personally from some things he said, I don't know if I should say it, but quite liberal, maybe quite surprising. So he really is a great leader, a great posek. If we had a Rav Lichtenstein, that would also be good. Someone who could speak about the broader humanistic concerns. But that's very important. I think, to set from the beginning. Now, one of the things I do in Scranton, I work there. I've, of course, since I've been there now, since 1996, I'm quite interested in Jewish history in Scranton. I'll get to Rabbi Kamel, what you say later. In Jewish history in Scranton, and Scranton has had a long Jewish history. Everywhere I go, I meet people from Scranton. Or they say, not themselves, but they say their parents, their grandparents from Scranton. Not that much left in Scranton, but a lot has come out of Scranton. It's a nice Jewish history. There were three great people who lived in Scranton. Oh, before I even get to that, Life magazine. In the 1950s, they did a thing, you can still buy it online. I'll show you now. They did a thing about religion in America. And lo and behold, they chose to focus on a Scranton family. This is Mrs. Fink, incidentally, the Fink family. They were my landlords when I lived in Scranton. She had passed away, but her husband was still alive, who ended up marrying the widow of Rabbi Louis Bernstein. So lo and behold, it says Scranton mother blesses Shabbos lights. So when they did a thing on Judaism in America, they focused on Scranton. Now, why they focused on Scranton? Of all the places, you can read the book, Vic Geller's book, his memoir. He was the reason why Life magazine went to Scranton. A number of years ago at the university, we did a thing about the Jews of Scranton. And lo and behold, look what we put on the cover. So I had a little article in here about three great people who were in Scranton. And there was a rabbi in Scranton who's a signer of the Israel Declaration of Independence. I'll give a minute, not even a minute, 10 seconds. Anyone type that in? Who knows who was the signer of the Israel Declaration of Independence who lived in Scranton? There's a rabbi in Scranton. Of course, he did many more things after he left Scranton. Let me show you. I'm going to show you his picture. Ah, Baruch has it. Very good, Baruch. So here, here is Zev Gold, Wolf Gold, who also is a founder of Torah Vadas, and he was a rabbi in Williamsburg, one of the founders of Torah Vadas. Here, incidentally, you can see him. Let me show you him at the March on Washington. He was the famous Rabbi's March. You see, he's speaking. I'll play him for a second. Over his to the right of him is Rabbi Eliezer Silver. He's not wearing his top hat, but that's Rabbi Silver. And they gave Rabbi Silver spoke a little also, but the major talk was Rabbi Zev Gold. Remember this, for those who don't know, this was a march of many, many Orthodox rabbis. I forget the exact number, to try to raise the conscience in Washington. They couldn't speak to FDR. The vice president came out to speak to them. And it was trying to show that they're concerned with what's going on in Europe. And we have to do something to help the Jews in Europe. Here is Rabbi Gold.
Pray and appeal to the Lord, blessed be He, that our most gracious President Franklin Delano Roosevelt consider and recognize this momentous hour of history and the responsibility which the Divine Presence has laid upon him, that he may save the remnant of the people of the book, the people of Israel. And we pray that the Lord
Okay, this was 1943, incidentally, that March. So that was Zev Gold. So that's number one. Number two, there was a great, another great builder of Jewish institutions in Scranton. And I don't remember if I had a, oh yes, here it is. I'll show you the picture. And it's related to Zev Gold. Maybe this even had something to do with the founding the Yeshiva Torah Vadas. Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz. We've spoken about in previous classes. Really one of the founders of the day school movement. He was rabbi in Scranton. It says teaching in a local Talmud Torah. And the last one. Let's see how many recognize this picture. He taught at the Hebrew school also there. This was a Hebrew school. They met 5 days a week. They read, let's say, Hebrew literature. That is none other than Harry Wolfson, the greatest scholar of Jewish philosophy in America in the 20th century. He's an old yeshiva bacher who then left that and moved into the academic world. So I wrote a little piece on on each one of them. However, I'm reading the old issues of Apartheid one day, and lo and behold, I see an article in there, a short article, a Torah article, by a rabbi, Eli Melech Schechter is his name, and he's a rabbi in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Well, I knew that Rav Herschel Schechter's father is Eli Melech. In fact, they call him Melech Schechter, just like they call me Melech, even though my Hebrew name is not Eli Melech, it's just Melech, but Melech Schechter is, everyone knows him as Melech Schechter, even though his name was actually Eli Melech. Eli Melech Schechter, what I know about, I knew that he was a rabbi in Pennsylvania. He had a PhD, by the way, at Dropsy College, so the old Dropsy College on the Mishnah, as it's quoted, I think, in Mishnah text quoted in the Yerushalmi or something like that. So I wrote to Rav Schechter. So here's the picture of Rav. Later he taught at YU, and he was known as an expert on Geirus. See, they don't even call him Eli Melech. They just call him Melech Schechter. And so I see this article in Apartheid. So I write to Rav Schechter. I write that, you know, being that I'm in teaching in Scranton, I've written a bit about the rabbis and the chachamim who live there. And I found this article in Apartheid from Rav Eli Melech Schechter, rabbi in Scranton. Apparently this is your father, I think. But is it? I want to know. And I want to know if you were born or lived in Scranton. Because here I'm always speaking about the important people who came from Scranton. And I had no idea there. Rav Herschel Schechter might have been from Scranton. So I'm asking him. And he says, that's true. I was born in Scranton in Mercy Hospital in July 28th, 41. So now you could add to the list of the people, important people from Scranton, Rav Herschel Schechter. And then he says, my sister was born there also. This was the first Rabbonus of my father. And then he says, when I was a year old, we went to Reading, Pennsylvania. My father was there. And then we went to Philadelphia in the Bronx. And then he tells about the house. The Epstein family in Scranton that I know is in the is in their house. And then he says as follows. He says, when I, in my books, when I want to cite, speak about a small town, like just a small town as opposed to a big city like Washington, I give an example of Scranton. Actually, also give Scranton a Paramus. Like I said, he says, like in one of his books, he says, I feel Ayarakatanak, Scranton, or Paramus. That's what he uses. And then he, then he says, in Paramus, I was a rabbi for a few years, Rabbi Guterman. Those who from Scranton remember Rabbi Guterman. He didn't come to my bris for some reason, but he promised he'd come to my wedding. But in the end, he wasn't able to come. And but we'll see. He doesn't say it here that he didn't know about it. But in the next letter, he actually says that that he did not know about this letter at all of his father. So that's just a historical point that Rav Herschel Schechter came from Scranton as well. Now, the next letter is also to Rav Schechter. And I have to tell you the background for this letter. I asked Rav Schechter if I the only rabbis I asked to publish their letters are Rabbi Mazuz and Rabbi Schechter, because some of the letters were maybe on issues, not just halachic issues. There's an assumption when you get a letter from a rabbi, a halachic letter, he assumes it's going to be made public. In fact, yeah, I think the big rabbis assume that every letter is going to be made public, even hashkafa letters. But I asked Rabbi Mazuz and I asked Rav Schechter about publishing letters, and they both said yes. However, I don't know if Rav Schechter would agree with publishing this letter, the next one. He didn't say anything when I gave him the book, but I think he might have been upset because of his modesty. But I felt it was important to publish, and so I did. So let me tell you the story, because I think it says a lot about the man as an individual. And people who know him as a person, there's many great rabbis who they're great in terms of learning, but if you see them up close, you know, things are not so good. The great ones, when you see them up close, you come away with the same impression. We have many stories of great Talmidei Chachamim, but when you see them up close, you see their personalities. It was difficult people. Everyone who knows Herschel Schechter up close speaks about him very kind, et cetera, et cetera. Why am I telling you all this? Because I think it's a very interesting story. I thought it was important to include the letter. He comes, as I said, every 2 months or so. He used to come. Now they do it on Zoom to my town to give these shiurim. So sometimes I go if I'm around. This was in, 4 years ago. So he came, it was before Pesach. He gave a shiur on Pesach. I've mentioned this before. I think it's one thing when he comes in to give a shiur, just to speak about issues. That's fine. I find it strange when they invite him in, like ask the rabbi, because there are local rabbanim. So fine, but if the rabbi I guess the rabbis will say, well, we're mochel and you can ask him. But the problem is, Rosh Hashanah comes in and he sometimes says things in opposition to what the rabbi said. And at that night, I've mentioned this before, he came in and he was asked about using those Listerine strips on Yom Kippur. It wasn't Pesach, but for Yom Kippur. Because you could ask any question. It was because the same thing, I guess it would be Pesach. If it's Mutter on Yom Kippur, it's Mutter on Pesach also. It's not Ochel. And he said it's permitted on Yom Kippur. And that was different than what people in the community had been told. So you always run into these problems. But after the class was over, someone asked me, the person who runs it, who organizes it, he asked me, would I drive him back to New York? So it's not far. It's that time of night. You get to Washington Heights, 30 minutes, 35 minutes from West Orange, New Jersey. So I said, fine. Sure, I said, fine. It's a big success here, especially because you can talk for all this time. And when you talk to Rav Shefty, you hear all sorts of interesting things. He tells it like it is. So the few times I had spoken to him before that. So I said, sure, I'll take him. And I don't use... I'm like the Rav. I don't use this third person. The rabbis in town, they speak to him in third person. Like, does the Rosh Hashiva say this? It's famous. They once asked the Rav this. Someone asked him, what does the Rosh Hashiva think? And the Rav was like, well, which Rosh Hashiva? And he said, you. I mean, which Rosh Hashiva? No, you. So he says, so why don't you say you? In English, it doesn't work like in German or Yiddish, third person. And when you speak to the president, you speak first person, second person. So it's a bit, I can never get into the third person unless you're trained in a certain yeshiva, but whatever. So I have him in the car. Now, I've been driving for, talking 35 years, whatever. I've only had one flat tire in my entire life. I've had a number of times that we all had where you come outside and maybe in the morning and you see the tire's a little low and you go and there's a nail in it. But actually on the road, it was like when I was 19 in my town, just a mile from my house. I've never had a flat. Lo and behold, I get him in the car and we're going. And right when we get on the highway, 280. 280, if you know West Orange, that's the road you'll take then to get to New York City. So literally 3 minutes, 4 minutes from the show, right when you get on 280, lo and behold, a big noise. And this is like 10 o'clock at night now, 10:15 at night. And because we don't have a Myriv after the shiur, went to like 9:30 and then he'd have Myriv and then people asking questions. And we didn't get out of there till like 10 or 5 after 10. So maybe 10 after 10 it was. A big noise and all of a sudden you hear like the wheel going. So I pull to the side and I get out and I'm like, we have a flat. So he says, okay, so we have a flat. So I call the AAA and I get in the car and we're waiting 15, 20 minutes. We're talking. And then I realized that they said it'll be like within an hour, but it's already now like 10:30, 10:40 or something. I'm like thinking this is not such a good idea. So I tell him I'm going to, because I said, I don't know, by the time they get here, it might be after 11. And I said, I'm going to call my friend, the guy who asked me to drive you and say, I have a flat to take you home. And he says, no, I don't want you to do that. I said, why not? He says, because I'm not going to leave you here on the side of the road all by yourself. So we sit for a little while longer and I'm, you know, he has to be up early in the morning. He has to give shiur. So I'm like, no, this is crazy. So I say to him, I'm calling him up. He has to take you. It makes no sense. So we get an argument. He says, no, it's not right. It's not, I can't leave you. I said, no. I said, well, I'm going to go home. They'll bring me. I'm 5 minutes from home once they change the tire, but you're not going to get home. It's not going to be till after midnight. You got to be up early in the morning. You have to do a shiur. So I convinced him. I convinced him got on the phone and I call this guy and he comes and he picks him up, gets there like close to 11 or so or quarter to 11. He picks him up and takes him home. And then the guy AAA came like 11:15, did my tire. I went home. A couple of weeks after that, I told him about the things I'm writing in the Svarim blog. So I sent him something I wrote and he writes back to me. Kavod Yikiri. He says, the first thing he says, Asir Todani Lachem, I am very thankful to you that you volunteered to bring me to New York. ומצטער אני על שעזבתי אותך באמצע הדרך. This is 2 weeks later. He says, I'm sorry. He's still feeling sorry that I left you in the middle of the road. ובאמת לא היה זה מן הנימוס. That was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. In other words, it wasn't respectful. I think that's an incredible thing. I think Rav Schechter probably wouldn't want that included here because I think it's important for the people to see that this is a Gadol Bisrael who has so much on his mind. People are calling him day and night. He's giving shirim day and night. And 2 weeks later, the first thing he's saying is, I had to force him to get in the car, basically, is that it still was bothering him and that he's upset that he left me on the road. And I think that says something about his sitkus. That because I know many rabbis wouldn't think twice and wouldn't bother them, maybe at the time, not later. This letter, I think, is important to show the midot, the ethical characteristics of this great Rosh Yeshiva, that weeks later, it still is bothering him. And he's upset that he left me, even though, of course, he should have left me. What is he going to do? He has to be up early in the morning. He has to teach all day. How is that going to? I'm a big boy. I can wait for the guy, the AAA to come. So I didn't ask him in particular about this letter because I thought he'd probably say, don't include it. Because he's an unav, but I think it's important for our community to see this. And then he says, thank you very much for what you sent me. I sent him a post dealing with the Dvar Avraham, the Rav of Kovno. And then thank you again for what you sent me about my father, which I still haven't studied. And I'm very thankful because I didn't know it all from this. So this is just a small letter. I called it Igeret Shalom, but I think it's important and for our community to know who he is, especially since so many people like to attack him for positions that they don't like, which is fine. You can disagree. But I sent him something where I expressed a different opinion, or I cited someone who expressed a different opinion. This is a halachic issue having to do with Corona. And he said, thank you for sending me it. I never said accept my opinion. I give my opinion. If people want to, he wrote this to me. It's going to be in volume 2. He said, if people want to accept my opinion, that's fine. But I never said kibudaiti, accept my opinion. That's like the Rav used to be like that. Okay, we have time for one more. No, actually, we don't have time because this will take a few minutes. The next tshuva. It's the last one we're going to have from Rabbi Mazuz. We've seen so many from Rabbi Mazuz. I've introduced you to Rabbi Mazuz, an interesting figure that many of you hadn't heard of. He was in the news just yesterday because of the election. He said as follows. Someone asked me who he supports. As prime minister, he supports Netanyahu, but not in terms of political party. So he said in his Saturday night shiur, if you're a Ben Torah, that is yeshiva student, I guess you should vote for one of the Haredi parties. But if you don't want to vote for the Haredi parties, then vote for the Religious Zionist Party. The problem with the Religious Zionist Party is they made these technical coalitions where you have this Kahanist. It's not one party, but they join together to pass it's just as a technical thing. So they join the votes together to pass the limit that you can get into Knesset. So that's, also, he said some strange things, Smotrich. But here you have Rabbi Mazuz saying, if you don't want to vote Haredi, vote for the Religious Zionist. And it could be the Religious Zionist is going to get more votes than they think. Apparently, many Haredim are disillusioned. Rabbi Yanki, the grandson of Rav Chaim Konevsky, says that you have to vote for the Haredi party to show you're a member of the community. Doesn't matter what they do, how good a party they are, just to show your community. So we will see what that does. It's 9:25, so we can take the questions now and the comments. So we're going to pick up, just so you see next time. The last thing for Rabbi Mazuz, getting us into a little bit of maybe higher criticism of the Talmud coming from Rabbi Mazuz, and how this is relevant to other matters. And then we'll see Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, Professor Yaakov Levinger. We're into a new section beginning next week. We only have about 40 pages to go, dealing with books and authors. And we're going to hear about the art scroll forgery, or I should say censorship, of Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Other interesting stuff, but we're coming to the end. Uh, I said I don't think we'll get to 55, but maybe 50. But we still have lots of interesting stuff. So let me go back now to the questions. We'll start at the beginning here. David says, since one may not prepare the salt water prior to Yom Tov, very nice. Buying it this year is one less thing to prepare before the Seder. I bet you, though, it'll be back next year and every year. Baruch says, basketball was invented in the U.S. Don't think it was big in Europe. Boy, he says jumping around. The story is told as basketball. Look, it's possible. It's possible that he saw the people, the irreligious people playing, and he said it. But the story in the halls of YU, the story deals with the YU guys. I already showed you the yearbook. YU had a tennis team, they had a basketball team, they had all these things. It was real sports. Baruch says, is this the Chabad idea similar to Christian doctrine of Jesus? At first, no, because they, they do say that the tomb is empty, but they do believe he was killed and then he was raised. So that's, but this Chabad doctrine, this strange Chabad doctrine says, Lo shino de geniza, that it's like Chanoch, you know, or Eliyahu, that sort of thing. And this is, but you have, it's called occultation, the Shia, you wait for the Mahdi, the final Imam, who's going to be brought back. And this is an important, for another reason, Bernard Lewis pointed this out that before he died, well, this is when Ahmadinejad was president. With the Soviets, we always knew that there was a mutual assured destruction. They're communists, so they don't believe in an afterlife or anything like that, and they don't want to die. So they knew that if they launch a nuclear bomb on us, we'd launch a nuclear bomb at them. So at least you can understand where each one was, and you could be assured that they're not interested in committing suicide. The problem with the Iranians is, and Ahmadinejad was a member of a group, this religious sort of group that believes in working to bring Mashiach, that is working for the return of the lost Imam. And one of the ways that they think that they could bring him is if the world becomes in such a difficult circumstances, or if there's a great conflagration, or through martyrdom, there's all certain ways. So if you have people who really believe that we can help bring the hidden Imam, and that if we were to, let's say, launch a nuclear weapon on Israel, and Israel were to respond by launching it on us, and that would create, we cleanse the Holy Land of the infidel, and we all this martyrdom. In other words, this is the sort of thing, Lewis said, that could help bring the final, you know, it's creating this apocalypse. It could bring the last Imam. And we know they're willing to commit suicide and kill themselves. We've seen it again and again. So, you know, just simply like you hear people say, well, who cares if they have a nuclear weapon? They know they can't use it because they know that they'll be destroyed by Israel or America. Who says? Bruno Lewis said, maybe that's exactly what they want. They want, especially Ahmadinejad, who was a member of this group that wanted to help bring through their actions, they thought they could bring the hidden Imam. So when people who believe in suicide as a service of God, you don't want to give them the opportunity to do that, I would say. Yes, thank you, Mel, for pointing it out. Baruch said, what I'm told is that the people in India, you probably have some in Israel as well, but the people in India are known as the real crazy ones in this respect. I've met Chabad rabbis who say that they don't even consider them Chabad. They speak of them as, I don't know if the people who were with me on a couple of years ago in Central Europe, I don't know if you were here when the Sefer Torah fell. That's how you remember when the Sefer Torah fell. So there was a big Chabad rabbi from California who was there that weekend as well. And he said to me, they're not even Chabad. I've never seen anything like these people. Look, I ate there and everyone goes there and you try to avoid that unless you hold like David Berger that you can't eat their food. But I didn't go that far. And to show you the Mesiras Nefesh, I had extra chocolate, which I brought. So I know they keep Chol Yisrael, which is a huge Mesiras Nefesh there, but I gave it to them because they have all these Israelis there. The reason the Chabad house is in the bad neighborhood, the poor neighborhood, is because these Israelis can't afford anything. They stay at these cheap hostels. So I gave it to him thinking, you know, you'd give it to some of these Israelis. You have some kosher food. Hardly any of them are Shomer Shabbos or anything. Some of them, you do find some religious ones, but most are not. And he said, well, it's not Chol Yisrael, so we can't use it. I said, but you can give it to people. He said, nope, he'll give it to the non-Jewish worker. And that's what he did. When I was there, it's really sad, you know, all these Israelis, they're there, they're searching, there's villages there which are full of Israelis, they're looking for something, which obviously they don't find in Judaism. At the Shabbos table, there even was a guy, he rode his motorcycle right up to the Chabad house. His father is a decently well-known, he told me. I never heard of him. But his father is decently well-known in the religious Zionist world. He runs a school. So you have even from religious people who are not religious anymore. But he told me about, he had visited that week, there's an Israeli who was caught smuggling drugs in from Nepal. And it's been like 3 years then. He still hasn't come to trial. He's being held up in some prison near the border. And he took his motorcycle to go visit him. I mean, you have all sorts of cases like this where people just caught in terrible situations. Shmuel says, how do the Geniza Mashiachis go from the Aron being hidden to applying that to a human being? Is there any source that applies such a concept to a righteous person? Well, they tried to derive it from something the Rebbe said in his in one of his sichot about the Nasi Hador, but really, do they need the prince of the generation? But do they need to have a source? They assume already by definition that the Rebbe's Mashiach, so he can't die. They assume it's at least they assume. I guess of course Mashiach can die, but then be resurrected. But they assume because understand their attitude is like he controls the world. And that nothing happens without the Rebbe's approval, and that you can turn to the Rebbe and he'll do things for you. I mean, they view him as a kin. It's almost like he's part of the Godhead in their understanding of it. So David says, here's a similar quote from Ervin 13b. Anyone who chases after Gedua runs away from him. So, but that's not kavod. That's not the exact phrase kavod, although it means sort of the same thing. Baruch said, how much of the letters come from the Rebbe? How much from his secretaries? I think the Rebbe definitely read it over because it has his handwriting in it. I assume he dictated it to him. But I don't know how much he didn't type it up. He wasn't doing that himself, typing it up. It's a good question. I'm going to ask, in fact, the author of that book. I'll get to the report for next week, David Zakalkowski, who wrote it. When he's writing to people, when he's writing to my father, he's talking about a historical thing. He's not giving it to someone else. The typical letters, which don't say very much, like the letter I got, I'm assuming the secretary wrote it. He just signed it. But I'll ask. But you can see in many of these letters, they're personal letters. So he dictated it to him, I guess. I don't think he, or maybe he wrote it in longhand. I will ask, though. It's a good question. I don't know. David says, the legal term for agent in Israeli agency law is shluchim, not shlichim. So in 65, it was still shluchim. But David says, shlichim in Hebrew often refers to the apostles of Jesus, and not Jesus himself, as per the polemical text in the Haggadah, lo al yedei hashliach. I didn't know that was polemical. I never assumed that, but maybe. What you mentioned about shlichim in Hebrew referring to the apostles of Jesus, in fact, Rabbi Mazuz says, that the reason in rabbinic Hebrew the plural of shliach is shluach, shluchim, and not shlichim is precisely because of what David says, that shlichim refers to the apostles of Jesus, but to which I have said, I wrote this in print, that I have found no evidence whatsoever that in the days of the Mishnah, or in the days, even in early rabbinic literature, that's what they referred to the apostles as shlichim. In other words, so therefore the Mishnah would use shluchim. I don't believe that is found until at least medieval period. Rabbi Kalman said he is the schus to be an official shechter for 4 years before he was famous. Mel says that Rabbi David Katz spoke about Dr. Montalto yesterday and pointed out that when he was summoned to treat French royalty on Shabbos, he was driven there in a carriage by a non-Jew. He was attacked for doing what he did and wrote a tshuva defending what he did. The problem is, I don't know who Dr. Montalto is. So if you can tell me who Rabbi Montalto, who wrote a tshuva, I don't know who that is. So maybe you can tell me, Mel. Him I've never heard of. And Rabbi Kelman says that he followed Rav Schechter's view in Toronto that... although it's not a popular view in Toronto among the rabbis, that to speak together with a Reform rabbi. The Reform rabbi gives his position, and then you give your position, the Torah position. Baruch says a doctor treating royalty is not necessarily the same as flying to Olympics on Shabbos. He didn't fly to Olympics on Shabbos. He flew back before Shabbos, and then he had to walk. But I said if a car came to him because he was summoned, I believe that any posek, and I've asked a few rabbis, would say if Putin summons you and says he wants you coming here, Of course you do that. It's a rabbinic prohibition, and the pikuach nefesh that we allow all sorts of things. Like I said, we treat patients, non-Jewish patients on Shabbos, d'oraisa. So I have no doubt that any post say, oh, Rabbi Oberlander himself, not Rabbi Oberlander, Rabbi Lazar himself is a Talmud Chacham, so he doesn't need anyone else, but he can decide himself. But I have no doubt that any post-seik would, and I know post-scheme have told people like Dov Zakheim and others, and these are people whose positions are not anywhere near the level of Putin, remember, of Lazar. Lazar could pick up the phone and call Putin and get through to him. It's David says, the question I have is, would the Rav today poskin that he did in the 50s that is preferable to miss T.S. a shofar than hear it in a conservative shul? Perhaps this view stemmed during a time of modern Orthodoxy was facing extinction, being swallowed up by a conservative movement, whereas no longer concerned both in light of the rise of Orthodoxy and the wane of the conservative movement. I think Rav Schechter, that's his position. That I don't think he says he's disagreeing with the Rav. I think he says that today we're not giving them legitimacy. First of all, they don't need our legitimacy, and it's not a battle anymore. They're the ones who are declining. It's we're not in a struggle. In the 50s, Orthodoxy was in the minority, and it looked like the future was with the conservative movement, and you had many of the younger generation, including children of rabbis. If you look at the rabbinical school and the seminary in the 40s or 50s, most of them came from Orthodox homes. Most of them came from Yeshiva College, I think, in the 1940s. I have the figures in the Lieberman book. So it's very different today. And Chabad doesn't have that issue either. They have no... I spoke when I in New London, Connecticut. This is taking back to 1996 when I was teaching at UConn. I was invited to an event there. I think it was Reform Synagogue, not a conservative. Maybe it was conservative. And it was me, the Chabad rabbi, and the conservative. And we each gave our talk, and no one thought we were giving them legitimacy. That's why Limud in England, the Haredi rabbis are very opposed to it. But Rav Schechter said, when I was at the first Limud conference, because I was invited, Rabbi Brander was there, and he said, I asked Rav Schechter. Rav Schechter said, go, it's very important. So that's this idea. And today, if you go to Adam Furzer has an article. If you go out west, let's say, you go to places like Denver, Texas, the Haredi Kollels, the Lakewood Kollels, are doing classes in conservative synagogues and reform synagogues. Everyone has concluded that today this is not an issue. Baruch says, was I named after someone whose name Melech? No, I was not named after Melech or Malka. My parents just like the name. I mean, Malka, they figure Malka, so why not Melech? There is a Melech Viswanath from the people from Tinek. His son is the one who, Viswanath, so you can see he's a Gert Tzedek. His wife is from a Yiddish background. It's their son who... translated Harry Potter into Yiddish. They made such a big deal about it. But Melech, his name is Melech also. And we're Melech together. And lo and behold, I run into him in India, where he was on sabbatical. But anyone who lives in Tinek knows Melech Viswanath, a Talmud Chacham, and a great, great Jew. Melech. So I'm happy that we share that name. Barry says, Ramel Schechter was my teacher of Yoredeya. He taught me how to sign my name properly as a witness and aid when he was in Masada Kedushin. And I said, he was also an expert in conversion and... How many years ago was the flat tire? The flat tire was about five years ago. I think it was 5 years ago. He doesn't have the name, the date on the tshuva. He has a date, not the year. David says, apropos of addressing rabbis in the third person, a student in Har Etzion asked his friend named Aaron, hey, Aaron, what is the time? Where Rav Lichtenstein was in earshot of the two students, immediately after the student asked his friend, Rav Lichtenstein immediately chimed in and told the students what was the time. Rabbi Weinberg tells a story. He tells a story about they were baking matzahs with Rav Itzla Blazer. And someone says Yitzchak to one of his friends, and Itzla answers the question. Jay Yellen, our good friend Rabbi Yaakov, I had the honor and pleasure of sitting next to Rabbi Schechter at an OU dinner in LA in 2014. First, he behaved exactly as you described, warm, friendly, and even occasionally funny. Also, my first wife had died a number of months before the dinner. We used to attend the annual OU West Coast dinner together, and Rabbi Schechter found out that during the course of our conversation, he was incredibly kind and provided great comfort and nechama. I'm quite certain he would not remember the conversation at the dinner, but I will never forget it. Thank you for recording that. And Shmuel says, do I record offer the background to the letter? Yeah, I do offer the background. Otherwise, people wouldn't know what it's about. Zahav says, a few more questions. Israel Knoll writes about the idea of resurrection at the start of the first millennium in regard to a Jewish general, successful for about 3 years, then killed, and seems to suggest that it is where what became the Christian sect got it from. there are some things that there's another text. I think maybe that's the one he's referring to, of a resurrected messianic figure. We do have a few passages like that, not mainstream sort of things, but Rabbi Sandy Shonel says at the time of the Depression, JTS and YU almost merged. Yeah, that you can look in one of Rakefet's articles. He has all the primary documents on this. The sticking point was Mordechai Kaplan. Finkelstein refused to get rid of Mordechai Kaplan. If Finkelstein would have gotten rid of Mordechai Kaplan, they could have, because then the seminary was still committed to halacha, and the differences were not that much, probably. And yesterday was Saul Lieberman's Yortzeit. I did not know that. When we finish with these classes, I'm going to do many classes, not this many, maybe five or six, on Saul Lieberman. He died on the plane on the way back to Eretz Yisrael. He died. Rabbi Shudnow, my teacher, Aaron Rothkopf, taught us at BMT that JTS and YU came close to merger. Yes. It was because of the money situation. I think the attitude was that JTS, the rabbinic, would be absorbed, and the scholarship, that was fine. So you'd have, like, there's a Bernard Revels, so that would be seminary. At that time, you didn't have any real theological issues that were really distinguishing them. Baruch, I didn't give the example of flying to the Olympics. I said if he was summoned and he had to do that, or then I gave a different example. If the car pulls up on Shabbos and says that Putin wants you, Rabbi Lazar, that's there's no posseg who would say not to do it. What I said was that he flew to the Olympics, and when he came back, he had to then walk home, and all the misnagdim mocked him and saying, what kind of rabbi is this that, Erev Shabbos, he's at the Olympics, not understanding that when Putin asks you to come there, you go. We have no idea what goes on behind the scenes in Russia, how many people Lazar has been able to help. And because of his close relationship to Putin. Dr. Montalto was a famous converso doctor, left Portugal and reformed fully to Judaism. Okay, now I remember. He went to, he ended up in Istanbul, if I recall correctly. He went, but he was not able to write a tshuva. Yes, he if anything, he got some rabbi in it. He ended up in, correct me if I'm wrong, he ended up in Istanbul. That's what it was, yes. Oh, yes. Okay. And finally, the last question, can I repeat the source, the material you referred to about the respective merger of JTS and YU? Well, you can read about it in a few different places, but the primary documents, there's this annual called Michael, doesn't appear anymore. He came out from Tel Aviv University, and Aaron Rakefet. Most of his stuff is more of the rabbinic stuff, quasi-hagiography, some of it. But that's a pure academic article in which he publishes the original documents from the YU side about the discussions about the merger between JTS and YU. I mean, look, Kaplan was a sticking point. That doesn't mean that if it wasn't for Kaplan, they would have been able to, in the end, do it, because the Rosh Yeshiva would have put up a fight. The question is, how important are the Rosh Yeshiva in determining things? The Rosh Yeshiva have put up fights about lots of things. They put up a fight about changing the charter of YU. They put up a fight every year. They'd have this, this social where they call it the Dean's something or another, where the boys and girls would come together. The Rosh Yeshiva have done lots of things, and they haven't had they didn't control it. So I don't know if in the end, but we don't know, but what would have happened. But that was always a sticking point. Mordechai Kaplan, Rabbi Herzog, came to America during the war years. He refused to step foot into, I think this was during the war years. He came one time during the war years, one time after. He refused to step foot in the seminary, even though Saul Lieberman was there, because he said he cannot step foot in a building that allows Mordechai Kaplan to teach. Implication being that if Kaplan wasn't there, at least he could have stepped in to go visit Lieberman. You'll see when we finish with these things and we do Saul Lieberman, it appears, at least Mordechai Kaplan claimed, that Saul Lieberman held the Chayrim while they were at the seminary, at least for a certain time on him. So, okay, so finally, the last thing now says, Rabbi Katz quoted the tshuva written by Montalto and said he probably had help in writing it. He must have had help. He was a doctor. He wasn't a Talmud Chacham like this. But I'll have to investigate this. And Sandy says, should Rabbi Gerson Cohen move the portrait of Kaplan? So when Cohen spoke, Kaplan's portrait was there. All I can tell you about Gerson Cohen is that traditionalist rabbis just to give you an example, David Feldman. I mean, you're saying it that he wanted to see the portrait of Kaplan. I'm assuming that's what you're saying. Rabbi David Feldman, the father of Rabbi Feldman of YU. In fact, Rav Schacht, here's something. I think I could say this because it's public knowledge. Everyone who went to the Jewish Center of Teaneck would have seen it. He told his son, Rabbi Feldman's son, his Rabbi Daniel Feldman, a big, big Talmud Chacham, a Bucky, he'll be a Rosh Hashiva. I think he is a Rosh Hashiva now, that he could daven in his father's shul, conservative shul, as long as he, it wasn't egalitarian. It was just conservative. There's no machitza, but that he should find a place where there's no women around and daven there out of kibud av for his father, respect for his father. He should find a place. And then that's a psak the Rav. Maybe the Rav would have given privately, publicly. He never would have said something like that. This David Feldman also was a very fine Talmud Chacham, wrote the standard book on birth control and Jewish law, which you could read like any Orthodox work. But David Feldman said that Gerson Cohen was a secularist. I'm not saying it. That's what David Feldman said. So Gerson Cohen's approach to Judaism. Now, Feldman, of course, was on the right-wing group that fought Cohen over women rabbis and all that thing. But there was no love lost between the conservative sides. And you're saying that Gerson Cohen loved Kaplan. A lot of people loved Kaplan. He had a big following. That's one of the reasons that Finkelstein couldn't get rid of him also. Finkelstein loved him. Finkelstein was a student of his. So, okay, there's a lot more to say. We will end here. Thank you all. We'll see you in a few weeks, Rabbi Kelman.
If I may, just on this last point, I believe you mentioned on one of our trips that David Feldman, had he been in the Orthodox world, would have been one of the poskim of our community.
Oh, there's no question about it. I asked him why I had a long conversation with him. In fact, one time, one of my long conversations was in Toronto, where he spoke for Torah in Motion. Remember, many years ago.
We had, for my mother's yahrzeit, Daniel, Rav Daniel, came with his parents, and they spoke the father and son, and it was very nice. It was very
and
nice.
His father was a rabbi out in Los Angeles, wrote a book on the Torah Tamima. This was the time in the 50s where they thought that the future was in the conservative movement, and he went there, but he had a great, great learning, and it's our loss that, although Rabbi Huda Herzl Henkin writes that his book on birth control, it's a perfect book, no problems, anyone could use it, but at the end, he was very disillusioned. I know someone who was at the one of the conventions, the RA, towards the end of his life, when he went, or the one of the last ones he went to, and Rabbi Feldman got up and started very emotionally saying, all this stuff you're talking about, what about Shabbos? What about Kashrus? Have we forgotten all about it? So I'm assuming he saw that as a career move, and you see how he educated his children. I mean, the children came out wonderful, wonderful children in a traditional Torah environment. I am certain, I didn't ask him this, but I am certain at the end of his life, he realized he made a mistake, and it was, he's not the only one. But yes, he would have been, it's a loss for our community.
I was Pinchas Stolper. He was a conservative rabbi in Flatbush. But my Pinchas was star father, yes, father. He has both the children at the Shir Flatbush, both the children, Pinchas Stolper and his sister. Some of his competing. Father was two, the old conservative rabbis.
Usually it's the other way.
The job was there, the money was there, the job was there. But until he sent to the yeshiva, he went from Yeshiva Fabian to Chaim Blinch, he went off to Shoah Central.
No, but I think for someone like Feldman, he didn't think that it would develop the way it did. It just became a form of, for most of them.
I know his son quite well. Feldman, yeah. Feldman's very disillusioned. This was the father.
Okay, well, thank you all.
Thanks. Okay, everybody. Lila.
Thank you, Barry. Yeah.
We'll see you. Please go out in 3 weeks. Have a Chag Kasher V'Sameach. Enjoy. Enjoy.
Chag Kasher V'Sameach, everybody.
All the best.
Chag Kasher V'Sameach.
Tomorrow, Dr. Benny on Tehillim. And on Wednesday, I mentioned the Haftorah. And Thursday, 11 a.m. 11 a.m. Parshat HaShavua. So that's the three more Shirim coming up this week. So hope you can join us, and everybody be
well. I will just say one more thing. If Daniel's still on, I can tell you that people called him Thinky, even not as a negative, just as a form of endearment, Thinky. Like when I went to BMT, we called Rabbi Horowitz, call him Whitey. He was at odds with Finkelstein. You could read the book, and he had issues with Finkelstein about certain things. But just be calling him Thinky doesn't, in a private diary, doesn't necessarily mean a, a negative thing. Okay, leave it at that. We'll pick up more later. Thank you.
Okay, Lila, to everybody. Be well.